Join the conversation.
Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
And it is 9:35, very nearly, nearly time for the Naked Scientist. He joins us every Friday. Just before we get to the Naked Scientist, another doctor has weighed in because Stephanie suggested that we should not be sowing any panic around Mpox. The doctor weighs in Afrikaans. He says, Stephanie praat net nonsense en moet verklaar waar sy haar graad in virology gewerf het. Ek vermoed dit is op Facebook. Dankie, Dr. Skrikke, for daardie boodskapie. And just to translate that for the purposes of Dr. Chris Smith, lecturer at the University of Cambridge, we've got an monkeypox outbreak in South Africa at this moment in time. At present, reported 13 people, men in their 30s, affected, two deaths attributed to this particular virus. And the doctors suggesting that this is not fear-mongering, this is very real, and we should be aware of things. I don't know if you are familiar with monkeypox and if you have any words to share about it. Chris?
Good morning, Clarence. We had a run-in with this in the last couple of years in the UK and internationally. We actually saw huge numbers of cases compared to how many we usually see. We normally see single numbers of cases on a every few years basis in the UK, and all of them exclusively imported cases, people who've been to an area where this infection is endemic, and then they bring it back with them. And then all of a sudden we started to see homegrown cases, evidence that this was in the community and it was spreading, and quite quickly it emerged that it was one particular community that was affected, and that was the gay community. And it looks like that somehow the infection was seeded into the gay community somewhere. We don't know exactly where, probably internationally, and it has started an endemic spread of the infection in that particular community, who have then, when they've travelled internationally, taken the infection with them, and it's then become endemic or been spreading in groups across a period of time in various countries. And so we had quite a big outbreak in the UK, which through contact tracing, information, telling people what to look out for, isolation of cases, vaccination of cases, and in some cases treatment, because there are some drugs that can be used, we were able to rein that in. And now we remain very, very vigilant for this, because what has happened once can happen again. Lightning can strike twice, and it looks like a similar sort of thing might be unfolding in South Africa. This infection is a relative of smallpox, and it was called monkeypox, now Mpox, because the infection is endemic in monkeys, but when it gets into people, which it can do through a range of different routes if you're in an endemic area and you come into contact with this virus, it causes a smallpox-like illness, but nothing like as severe and nothing like as infectious. It's much harder to spread this round and cause big outbreaks. And so we were able, luckily, to get on top of what happened, but it's a warning shot over our bows that nature has a very deep set of pockets from which it can deliver all kinds of surprises. And as our population grows, as our travel increases, and as more people spend more time in more other people's company and have close personal contact, which is how this virus was spreading, you're going to see this sort of thing. So that doctor's absolutely right. Information and vigilance is absolutely critical. And I sat on a number of committees and meetings when we began to get this problem in the UK, and people were saying, we don't want anyone to feel targeted or anyone to feel the fingers being pointed. And someone who was on that call who said, look, I'm gay, and if there's something which is really, I'm at high risk of, I want to know about it. And I think my fellow homosexuals would very much like to know if there's something they can look out for, they can make sure they're not exposed to, and that they can tell their friends. So information is really, really important in this sort of setting. Make sure you know what's going on.
Is it curable at all?
Yes, it's not a lethal disease in the vast majority of cases. There are two forms of it. Most of this comes from Western Africa. There are places in Western Africa where this is an endemic infection, and there are two different what we call clades or forms of this virus. And one form tends to be a bit more trivial than the other, we think, based on the epidemiology. It might be that it's a bit of bias because of the certain populations that catch it, poorer people, less well-nourished, more vulnerable. Maybe they get more severe infection per se anyway. But what we saw when it got into Western populations in large numbers, which gave us good data to go on, was that for the vast majority of people, this is a relatively mild disease. You do get symptoms, you do feel pretty awful, but not for very long, and then you do get better, and then you're immune, and you're not going to get it again, because once you've had this, you develop a really robust immune response, which will produce long-term protection. But not everybody is endowed with a really good immune response, especially in countries with a high prevalence, for instance, of HIV, which can erode the immune system and make you more vulnerable. And so this is why this is more of a threat for some people and why people need to be aware.
Let's go to Denise. She's on the line in Tableview. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you, Clarence. Good morning, Doctor. I'd like to ask you, if one had a heart transplant or a liver transplant, etc., would the donor's DNA be in your body?
Yes, it absolutely would. Now, let's go for one of the most radical examples of this. Let's go for a bone marrow transplant. That's an organ as well, bone marrow. It makes all of the elements of your blood, white blood cells, red blood cells, the clotting elements called platelets. When we give people a bone marrow transplant, for instance, because they've had some kind of bone marrow or white blood cell cancer, like myeloma, or they've had lymphoma, we obliterate their own bone marrow, and we then find bone marrow from somebody who is a very close genetic match to that person, but not the same, because we want healthy bone marrow to go in. We take stem cells, bone marrow cells, from the donor person, infuse them into a vein in the recipient person after their own bone marrow, including the diseased bone marrow, has been destroyed with chemotherapy and sometimes radiotherapy. The stem cells then migrate back to the bone marrow of the recipient, and they know where the bone marrow is via some signals. They know where to go. They home in on the bone marrow space, and they begin to divide. And you will then see it takes 2 or 3 weeks before the person engrafts, and then you see their cell counts beginning to rise. Instead of having to give them blood transfusions every day, we see them making more of their own blood, and critically, we can see the level of white blood cells go up in their bloodstream. The only source of those white blood cells is going to be the donor bone marrow, and sure enough, if you test them, you will see that the DNA of those white blood cells is not the recipient. Those cells are not theirs. They came from outside, and they're now a new growing population in a new body. They are the DNA of the donor person. So if someone really nefarious wanted to commit a crime, what they would do is go and have a bone marrow transplant after they'd done the crime, and then offer a blood sample for DNA testing, and it wouldn't match. And then they say, look, I'm being very facetious, of course, but no, you're absolutely right. When you put a foreign organ into a person, you are getting their cells and their tissues, which do not get replaced by the person's own cells and tissues all the time, in all cases, and therefore there will be that person's DNA in your body, and you become what is known as a chimera, or if it's just one population of cells, a micro chimera. And you think this is a rare thing. It's not. Everyone who has been a mother listening to this program and has had children, your children's DNA is still in your body. And there was an amazing paper a few years ago. Scientists were able to show that if you follow people who've been pregnant through their life course, you can find, if a mother has had a son, you can find cells with a Y chromosome in them in the mum's body in various places 2 decades, 3 decades later. Because when the baby's growing inside the mum, some of the baby's stem cells spill over into mum's circulation. They go around the tissue, around the bloodstream, and they take up residence in various tissues, and they stay there for extended periods of time, and in some cases they might actually drive the immune system to attack the organ that they end up taking up residence in. So this can cause autoimmune disease, and that's one of the reasons why we think women, especially women who have been pregnant, are at higher risk of autoimmune disease compared to equivalently matched men.
Okay, let's get to that hangover question. Why is the same culprit responsible for bringing relief? Does it even? Who shared with that question?
Well, what is a hangover, first and foremost? A hangover is because you have poisoned yourself. When we drink alcohol, alcohol is toxic and it gets detoxified in your liver, which has a series of metabolic steps that turn the alcohol from a poison and something capable of affecting the way your brain works into vinegar, acetic acid. The way it does this is, first of all, an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase turns the alcohol, ethanol, into a substance called ethanal, or acetaldehyde. And this is actually not that dissimilar chemically from formalin, the stuff we use to fix and embalm bodies. So that's nasty, very toxic, and a potent inflammatory agent. And so the body very quickly tries to dismantle that, and it turns the ethanol or acetaldehyde into acetic acid, which you can then pee out. Now, when you make that formalin-like substance, acetaldehyde, it causes inflammation all around your body, and that includes in the meninges, which surround your brain. So you get a headache for that reason. You also have the flushing reaction. You look red and you feel hot because you've pushed blood into the surface layers of your body. And it's also quite a potent diuretic, all these things. So you tend to, you lose a lot of water from the body. And it irritates your stomach, the alcohol directly. So there's a triple whammy going on. You've got the alcohol irritates your stomach and that makes you feel horrible and can make you throw up, which can dehydrate you and upset your salt and water balance. You make a potent inflammatory chemical, which goes around your body, winds up all your tissues, pulls the immune system into them and makes them hurt. And that makes you have some of the hangover symptoms. And it makes you pee too much, which means you upset your salt and water balance further. So you feel horrible for that reason. When you bring all those things together, wow, I feel dreadful. So if you then go and have more to drink, you're putting water back into the body. If you drink wine or beer or something, even though you've got a hangover, you're still putting some water back into your body with some alcohol in it, admittedly. But when you put the alcohol back in, it hasn't got any of the nasty inflammatory chemicals in it yet, has it? Because they take time to metabolize. So your body's craving water, which you're putting in. Your body's also craving sugar, because the process of breaking down alcohol robs your body of the ability to produce glucose for your bloodstream from your liver. So you feel horrible because you're tired, horrible because you haven't got enough sugar, and horrible because you're dehydrated. You're addressing a couple of those problems with, I'll have a quick drink, and that makes you feel a bit better instantly. But then, of course, it winds up all the other processes again. So it's a short-lived relief, if any, and you're just putting off the inevitable. So the best thing to do is obviously not to do it in the first place. But we all know that we all have heavy nights sometimes. Yeah. So reverse those symptoms, put the water back in, put the salts back in, and treat your stomach kindly for a day or so, and you should be back to normal. And the best thing to use, actually, oral rehydration fluids. Those sachets you can buy when you get DMV, or you get them for little kids to try and make sure they don't get dehydrated when they've got an upset tummy. They're brilliant, actually, as a hangover remedy. So pop a couple of paracetamol, if you can take paracetamol safely, obviously, and you're at the right age, right dose and all that, and take some oral rehydration therapy, and it will help to reset the salt and water balance and sugars, and you'll feel a lot better very, very quickly.
That's some really good advice. Thank you, Dr. Chris Smith, lecturer at the University of Cambridge, our very own Naked Scientist, exclusively ours. These are some of the questions in via WhatsApp. Let's take a listen, Joe.
Hey, Dr. Chris and Clarence, Ed here with a question. Can you get bird flu from bird poo?
The answer is yes. If you want the longer answer, the answer is that in birds, which are the natural hosts of flu, that's where the flu virus originated originally, thousands of years ago, it was an avian or bird virus. In them, it is not a respiratory infection. In birds, flu is an enteric infection. It goes in the top end and they poo it out the bottom end into the water. And because it's usually aquatic birds that are the origin of flu and they carry flu, when they're pecking around in the water and sort of getting weed and things and finding things under the water surface, they are therefore picking up into their mouths excrement from other birds, including any flu virus they were shedding, and that's how the virus transmits. And when it gets into birds that live in, say, chicken houses and so on, same thing. Goes in, causes an intestinal infection, the birds poo out the virus into the environment, other birds like chickens will come along pecking around and pick up the virus that way. In us, it behaves a bit differently, and this is because the receptors, in other words, the thing that the virus uses to grab hold of our cells, the target for those receptors in birds is in their gut. The target for those receptors on the virus in us is in our respiratory tract, and hence it's a respiratory virus in us and mammals like us. It is an intestinal infection in birds.
And another voice note in.
Good morning, Clarence and Dr. Smith. I've got a quick question. Why do birds bob their head when they walk? I've got a couple of chicks in my house, and when I see them walking, they're always bobbing their heads. And I thought, why do birds bob their head when they walk?
Interesting. And it's nothing to do with the fact that the skin on one side of the bird is too short, so they have to move their head to keep them from stretching. Someone said that to me once. No, it's true. And if you watch a bird fly, they don't bob their head around at all. They hold their head razor sharp still. When they're walking, they do move their head backwards and forwards. Let's have a think about that. So the bird keeps its head fixed in space. It then moves its body under its head to take a step forward. Then it moves its head forward a certain distance and locks it again, moves its body under its head again, keeping the head very still. Why would it do that? Well, the reason is, look at where the eyes are on a bird. They're on the side of the head. And the bird would become visually very disorientated if it were to just walk along with its head held in one position relative to its body and the world would stream past its eyes. It would make it much harder to see what was going on. When it's flying, it doesn't have a choice. When it's walking, it does. And what it does is lock its head in one position, and that means it can fix its gaze on what it's seeing at that point, get a clear image, and then move the body under the head so that it then quickly moves the head to the next position and fixates again, and in this way make sure it's not missing things that might come along and turn into lunch.
Okay, we got another voice now. Let's go there, Joe.
Hey, Chris. Hi, Adam here. My question today is the word humour, like someone who's funny, who's got a sense of humour. I was recently told that it's got a medical origin from like ancient Greek medicine about the humours being fluids in the body. I wanted to find out if you know anything about that, the origin of the word humour and why it perhaps means funny. Thanks, sir.
Hi, good question. I don't know the answer because I'm not a medical historian. But, and if anyone is and knows the answer to this, then do please ring up and correct me. But I'm going to speculate. People knew that the brain had fluid inside it, going back to the ancient Egyptians. The surgeon to the pharaohs, Imhotep, actually wrote in the Edwin Smith surgical papyrus found from thousands of years ago, that the Egyptians knew that if someone had a bad head injury and you stuck your fingers in through their skull and pressed on their brain, you would make them shake and shudder. Actually, what you were doing was triggering an epileptic seizure. But what they thought when they looked in the brain was there are all these fluid-filled spaces. They thought, well, the brain has fluid, nerves are like long straws out to the muscles, so therefore when you move, your brain squeezes fluid down the nerves and into the muscles and blows them up and makes them move. So that's what they thought. And probably from that came this whole idea of there are humours, there are important fluids in the body, which include blood and bile and, as we've been mentioning, the stuff that's in your head. And from that came the idea that, well, that is the seat of thinking then. There must be some humours which drive thinking and thought and humour, and humouring someone, giving them thinking time, your attention and so on. I think that's probably where that word came from. And then having a sense of humour, the ability to make your brain think and think along other people's wavelength and sort of laugh together. I think that's probably where that came from. But if anyone knows the derivation of that word and my speculation is wrong, please do put me right, because that's how this program works. We all learn off each other.
And we're going to squeeze in one last question. What is Dr. Chris's take on the law of attraction? Is there a scientific basis?
Oh, yes, there absolutely is a scientific basis. Obviously, everyone has their own unique tastes in the kind of person and persons they fancy. But a lot of this is just down to how our brain works. And there are a number of important chemicals in the brain that affect our feelings for each other. Probably foremost among them is the chemical oxytocin. And Brian Ferry sang oxytocin and said, "Love is a drug." And is addicted to love. Well, this is how oxytocin works. It is released in your brain when you bond with somebody, and when a mother bonds with her baby, when an animal mother bonds with her baby, when two animals bond together for life, like some swans do, for example, and when humans do, there is a release of oxytocin in the brain through a range of different processes. This can include, in the case of mothers and babies, when a baby is born, it stimulates a huge release of oxytocin in the mum's brain. And this seems to drive bonding behaviour for those that she's close to, in other words, the baby. And this also encourages the release of breast milk. And when breastfeeding happens, this also produces more oxytocin, which again reinforces the bond between a mum and a baby. But when two people are making love, They also release oxytocin in both of their brains, bonding them together, just like a mother and a baby bonds together. So that's why sex is the glue that binds people together. Then there's another one. There are other agents, arginine vasopressin, AVP, in the brain, which also controls how much water you've got in your bloodstream. But in the brain, it does a very important job with fidelity. And scientists have shown that people who tend to stray in a relationship have a different form of the receptor, the docking station, that recognises the AVP signal in the brain compared to the general population. And this is also mirrored in animals. There are animals that are very promiscuous. There are animals that are much less promiscuous. They are monogamous. If you take the gene from the monogamous animal and put it into the polygamous animal or vice versa, you can change the behaviour of those two groups. So while it sounds very romantic, falling in love and all that, it is very much driven by neurochemistry, and it's all about the connections between nerve cells.
We need to wrap it there, unfortunately, and a big thank you, as always, Dr. Chris Smith, our naked scientist, exclusively hours 9:30 to 10 on a Friday. Some news coming your way next.